on breadboxmedia.com is Setting Records Straight, Chuck Coughlin. This is the second of two shows that I'm doing called Lust for the Mud, about our primitive urge to get all dirty and slimy, to return to a fabled, mythical, but falsely praised native state. I'm going to go on, but I want to remind you to support our hosts. Look around the website. There's a way to keep us alive, to keep the lights on, to keep these podcasts coming. We have hundreds of them in the vault. There are going to be more put out on the website as time goes on. If you want to support me, I'd be greatly charmed. Oh, I love this subject. Come along. Come with me again. Pick up the train of our thoughts about the nostalgia for the mud, the lust for the mud, nostalgie de la boue. Meditating, considering this subject pays big rewards, understanding why we want things maybe we should not have. Considering, focusing, paying attention to our inner urges, including the one to re-enter the mud, the primitive, the untouched state. Well, we've been reflecting on some interesting information, on some common romantic illusions about some of the more primitive religions and the nature religions and the mother goddess religion. Nothing wrong with studying them for what they are, but let's be accurate. And let's identify the romantic fantasies where they exist. We were talking about our desire to have nostalgia for the mud, or nostalgia for the primitive life, the fantasy about Tarzan and Jane, and the powerful tendency within our culture to sentimentalize the third world cultures. A great many people trace this intellectual era back to the noble savage, the concept of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Now, Rousseau lived in the 1700s. A modern French writer, Pascal Bruckner, has written a very effective response to this concept of the noble savage. In the 80s, he published a book, The Tears of the White Man, Compassion as Contempt, Free Press, 1986. This valuable book did get a little attention from conservatives, but it was short-lived. Bruckner's book is a vigorous indictment of third-worldism, that species of romance that glorifies everything foreign, exotic, and primitive, while simultaneously railing against civilization, science, Christianity, and modernity. While the power of Bruckner's indictment helps to explain its neglect, because the message he brought was distinctly unwelcome music to the ears of politically correct intellectuals, whose smugness and sense of moral superiority then as now was inextricably bound up with the mendacities of third worldism and kindred specimens of emotional blackmail. Bruckner wrote that solidarity with oppressed people is above all a gigantic weapon aimed at the West, and this has made it a continuation of the Cold War by other means. Being European or American and being supported by a Western power is enough to make one suspect. What seems criminal in Cuba, Angola, and Guinea has the real purpose of washing away the far greater crime of colonialism. At least that's the way the argument goes. Now, Bruckner's message is full of meaning today as it was in the 80s, maybe more so, because today those attitudes are more thoroughly institutionalized, more thoroughly absorbed into established opinion. Well, first of all, who is this man, Pascal Bruckner? Well, he's somebody with firsthand knowledge of the problems he's written about. He worked as a member of the International Action Against Hunger. He animated compassion with deeds. If this tempered his romanticism, it also sharpened his vision. He did not rail against Western oppression. He did not curse the evils of colonialism. On the contrary, he understood that the West's real crime was not pursuing, but rather abandoning its responsibilities. And you could say those are the responsibilities of a colonial power. Or you could say that those are the responsibilities of a companion nation. Part of what makes The Tears of the White Man such an important book is Bruckner's sensitivity to the aerodynamics of liberal guilt. He understands what launches it, what keeps it aloft, and how we might lure it safely back to earth. He understands that the entire phenomenon of third worldism is fueled by the moral ecstasy of overbred guilt. Bruckner is an articulate describer of such guilt. He points out that, quote, an overblown conscience is an empty conscience. Compassion ceases if there's nothing but compassion. You could call it soft pity. It's stimulated when guilt becomes a convenient substitute for action, where action is impossible. We resort to soft pity as a convenient substitute for not knowing what action to take. Without the power to do anything, sensitivity becomes our main aim. Our aim is not so much to do anything, it's to be judged. Salvation lies in the verdict that declares us to be wrong. In a way, this makes compassion trivial. It's not directed toward an individual because it's become universal. Roger Kimball has observed about this, that a sort of universal compassion becomes so thinly spread that it becomes trivial. This trivialization is one side of third worldism.
Another side is the inversion, the turning upside down of moral and intellectual values, the complete reversal of the polarity, so that what was good becomes bad and what was bad becomes good, an inversion of the moral and intellectual values.
The West and Christendom once sought to bring enlightenment, literacy, civil society, modern technology, and the Christian religion to parts of the world that needed it and didn't have it. It did this in the name of progress and civilization and bringing souls to Christ that would have never known him otherwise. The ethic of third worldism dictates that yesterday's enlightenment be rebaptized as today's imperialistic oppression. Bruckner has said that for these third worldist people, that their great goal is not just the interchange of cultural influences, but in the recognition of the superiority of foreign thought, in the study of their doctrines, and in the conversion to their dogma. In other words, the recognition of the superiority of foreign thought. Do you recognize an aspect of the love of the exotic that characterized the adolescent romantic? The third worlders fervently believe that we should take on our former subjects as our models. There's a long list of these objects of our adulation. The wisdom of the East, tribal Africa, Aboriginal Australia, pre-Columbian America. The message is the same. The absolute superiority of otherness, of the exotic. The third worldist looks to the Orient, to the tribal, to the primitive, not for what they really are, but for their evocative distance from the reality of modern Western society and values. It's all part of what Bruckner calls the enchanting music of departure. Boy, what a very French phrase that is, the enchanting music of departure.
His siren call is seductive, but fraudulent, also fraudulent.
Indeed, the messy reality of the primitive world, its squalor and poverty, its penchant for cannibalism, slavery, gratuitous cruelty and superstition, are carefully edited out of the picture. In its place, we find a species of the sentimentality of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau is the patron saint of third worldism. Think of what he wrote. Here's what Rousseau wrote. Ignoring the real human race entirely, I imagined perfect beings with heavenly virtue and beauty, so sure in their friendship, so tender and faithful, that I never could find anyone like them in the real world. That's a quote from Rousseau's Confessions. The beings with whom Rousseau populated his fantasy life are exported to exotic lands by the third worldist, as Rousseau discovered the unreality of his scenario. Far from being an impediment to moral smugness, was an invaluable asset. It was an asset. Reality, after all, has a way of impinging upon fantasy, clipping its wings, limiting its exuberance. As Bruckner notes, and so the people who entertained this romantic vision were not looking for a real world, but the negation of their own. An eternal vision is projected on these nations that have nothing to do with their real history. The Australian anthropologist Roger Sandall does not mention the tears of the white man in his book, The Culture Cult. He goes farther than Bruckner in calling this romantic primitivism and designer tribalism. How's that for a marvelous phrase? Designer tribalism. What is designer tribalism? It is the unending revolt of the civilized against civilization. What Sandall describes as the culture cult dreams of a new simplicity, a mode of existence that is somehow less encumbered, less rent by conflicting obligations than life in a modern industrialized democracy. What a vain dream. The romancing of the primitive only emphasizes one's distance from its simplicities.
Romanticism, in all its forms, is a retrospective phenomenon.
Like autumn, the more fervid it is, the more it underscores the loss it laments. Isn't life about ever-extending complexity? To deny that is to neglect the big ditch that separates the modern world from its primitive societies. On one side of the big ditch is the rule of law, near universal literacy, modern technology, and at least in some periods a fully realized Christianity, and the whole parade of liberal democratic largesse. And what is on the other side of the big ditch? Domestic repression, economic backwardness, endemic disease, and severe artistic constraints. If you want to live a full life and die in your bed, then civilization, not romantic ethnicity, designer tribalism, deserves your thoughtful vote.
The culture cult is partly a brief of enlightenment values.
Of universal culture and scientific rationality, and partly an attack of the various atavisms that Sandel sees impeding the growth of these values. So actually the real target here is the assumption that culture is a value-neutral term and that one has to fight against ranking cultural differences. In other words, we shouldn't make discriminations. They're all good, all equally good. One anthropologist, Claude Levi-Strauss, famous one, there's no such thing as a savage mind as distinct from the civilized mind. There is a politically incorrect observation, and it is a simple empirical fact, that some people are better than others, smarter, harder working, more learned, more productive, harder to replace.
Some ideas are better than others, some values more enduring, some works of art more universal. Some cultures, although I dare not say it, are more accomplished than other cultures, and therefore more worthy of study. Every corner of the human race, of course, has something to contribute, but we cannot process from that all contributions are equal. In this podcast on Breadbox Media, we've been reflecting on what is called
cultural relativism, the equating of all cultures as being of equal value, and also on the exaggerated reverence paid to less advanced cultures, sometimes called third world cultures. Often our view of what these cultures are like are presented to us in a haze of romantic fantasies that prevents us from seeing the truth of what these cultures are really like. That prevents us from really seeing the truth, and that serves no one well. This thing called designer tribalism puts a premium on quaintness, which then it embroiders with a rhetoric of authenticity. There are two problems in this process. First of all, it becomes increasingly difficult to tell the truth about the achievements and liabilities of other cultures. The other casualty is a moral, social, and political one. Who suffers from the expression of romantic primitivism? Not the elite of the world. Here's the point. The people who suffer are the object of the romantic's compassion.
Should our Native Americans
and New Zealand Maoris and Australian Aborigines be urged to preserve their traditional cultures at all cost? Should they be told that assimilation is wrong? And is it wise to leave them entirely to their own devices? The best chance of a good life for indigenous people is the same as for you and me.
Fluent and literate command of a written language, like English in the United States.
As much math as we can handle, and a job.
Is that a strange thing to wish for?
This is the truth that was broadly recognized, at least through the 1950s. With the failure of colonialism, however, came a gigantic failure of nerve. It might be said, in fact, that the failure of colonialism was a gigantic failure of nerve. More and more confusion replaced confidence, and with confusion came the pathologies of guilt. Isn't it a folly to leave native peoples locked up in their old-time culture? That ought to be obvious. Underlying much of our present attitudes is an assumption that we're on the same plane of social development, divided only by misunderstanding. Sandel emphasizes that's a false assumption. And it was recognized as false by governments everywhere until around 1970, when the big change set in. Then, instead of helping the more primitive cultures to enter the modern world, we were enjoined to admire them and their idealized way of life. And the effect on these indigenous people romanticizing their past has been devastating. If your traditional way of life has no alphabet, no writing, no books, no libraries, yet you're continually told that you have a culture which is rich, complex, and sophisticated, how can you realistically see your place in the scheme of things? If all such hyperbole were true, who would need any books? Who would need to write? Why not hang up a gone fishing sign and head for the beach? I might do that myself.
As a matter of fact, when I finish this podcast, I'm going to think about that. Let me give you a rather tragic real-life example. This actually happened.
In Australia, policies inspired by the culture cult have brought the return to illiteracy of thousands of Aborigines whose grandparents could read and write. Think of the tragedy of that. Other statistics are just as grim. Between 1965 and 1975, Aborigines arrived at one college with sixth grade reading levels. 15 years later, in 1990, after primary education had been handed over to local Aboriginal communities, that had fallen from sixth grade to third grade. Today, 25 years later, most Aborigines arrive at the college in question almost completely illiterate. This is a tragedy. It was a tragedy and a disaster that was a result of specific political policies. But the policies themselves were the result of a moral attitude, one in which many anthropologists have actively nurtured.
As a matter of fact, it's the non-hierarchical view of culture.
It's a view that denies there are important distinctions to be made between the thoughts of the indigenous person and the mind of, for example, the anthropologist himself. In part, what we might call the anthropological attitude is a coefficient of the idea that culture is at bottom a narrative, a product of social construction, and the results of that development, corrosive skepticism, blasé nihilism, irresponsible relativism, have helped to place anthropology in intellectual disrepute. For the last few decades, anthropologists have written about constructing reality, as if the world and everything in it were mere artifacts, about building identity, as if any old self-glamorizing fiction will do, about creating the past as an enterprise more exciting than real history, about inventing tradition as if traditions were changeable as home furnishings, as if indeed. So we have designer tribalism, and what lays behind it is an ethic that foists all of one's own attitudes and longings onto the apparently blank canvas of whatever primitive populace happens to be in vogue at the moment. To some extent, this is simply a matter of ignorance. We can illustrate it by Christopher Columbus's report on his first voyage. Sweet man, that the people he discovered are, quote, very gentle and know nothing of evil. And he really believed it. He discovered later that the Caribs he was dealing with were cannibals. We have a lot more contact with other societies these days. Much more contact. So such romantic projection is not so excusable. But the cultural cultist supplements ignorance with heavy helpings of ideology. He looks at an exotic culture, and behold, finds himself looking into a flattering mirror. This is one reason that natives are always seem to be described as non-smoking, vegetarian, sex-worshipping, drug-taking, eco-conscious, progressive-thinking pacifists, according anyway to the press releases distributed by the cultural cultists. This is modern anthropology's tendency to normalize the primitive while treating the civilized as an aberration. In New Zealand, they're promoting the revival of traditional Maori culture. Who is? Well, to some extent, the Maoris themselves, but much more energetically. It's being promoted by an army of teachers, academics, government servants, clergy, radical lawyers, progressive judges, journalists, and numerous other elites. An Anglican priest railing against the monocultural grip on all our institutions that British colonials supposedly still exerts. And cites various teachers who wish to return the education of Maori children to the tribes. There's an assumed background is a rose-tinted view of the Maoris as a peace-loving, ecologically conscious, spiritually delicate people who have been abused for two centuries by hard-bitten, materialistic Europeans. The true ecological record of the Maoris would not win any awards from the Sierra Club. They arrived in New Zealand 800 years ago. They indiscriminately burned huge swaths of forests. They decimated the wildlife. Actually, decimate is far too weak a word. Within a short time, some 30% of the bird life in New Zealand had become extinct, thanks to the depredations of the Maoris. All 12 species of moa, the large flightless bird, without any natural predators before the Maori arrived, became extinct some 600 years ago. It was probably the fastest extinction of large creatures ever recorded. Not that the Maori were particular about where they got their protein. They were divided into numerous tribes, who were always at war. Prisoners were routinely baked and eaten. But all this is papered over. And even as the Maori past is systematically distorted and rewritten, so their future is jeopardized by government policies that, in the name of biculturalism and preserving tribal customs, dooms its beneficiaries to a life of second-class citizenship. You know, in conclusion, it's pretty well known today that Margaret Mead's book, Coming of Age in Samoa, should be filed under fiction, not anthropology. Mead herself acknowledged that in populating the South Seas with sexual libertines, she was pushing speculation to the limit of accessibility. But her book, as well as Ruth Benedict's On the Pueblo Life of the Zunis and Patterns of Culture, is another example of didactic semi-fiction and has been immensely influential, especially among the young college crowds of the 60s and 70s. Both of these books were part of a tsunami of misinformation that legitimized the bohemian counterculture of Greenwich Village, first in the universities, and then in the 60s in the culture at large. It's very important to understand that what passed as anthropology was really a species of fantasy. The Culture Cult is a book that is a valuable addition to the literature of common sense. It exposes a reign of ideology and mystification in an academic pursuit, first of all, but also as it has spilled over into the culture at large. We can agree with Sandel that cultures differ profoundly, and these differences have profound effects. If we're lucky, the future belongs to the values that made Christendom the economic, political, scientific leader of the world.
And of course we do have the duty to obey God. Christ gave us a grand commission. A duty that we must do, we must perform it, to go forth and preach the gospel to all nations. But that's not enough. We have to baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. To put it simply, we all have the mission to save souls, to love and cherish our fellow man enough to want to save his soul. There was a man that once made a wonderful observation.
That it is a mistake of great historical significance that has been made in modern times in adopting a doctrine which treats traditions as the detritus, the trash of the forward movement of society. There are many ways in which our traditions and cultural practices are of value and can be considered gifts to people that they can refuse if they desire. The greatest gift we can give is our Catholic faith, which is a tradition. And when you view it with thoughtful reflection, it becomes apparent that that tradition from Christ is the foundation and supporting girders of the magnificent culture that resulted in Christendom. Not only should we share it if it is willingly received, there's more that we should do.
If we're confused about the right path, from this moment in history, where we stand, you and I, there's no need for such confusion. Christ said, do this with compassion, with love. Each one of us is a missionary for the culture of Christ. This immense development, this huge evolution and flowering of culture that happened in the Christian world. We need to go on cultivating that garden. And we need to evangelize boldly and with courage. We need to bring everyone on earth
to the body and blood of Christ, to receiving the body and blood of Christ in that intimate spousal relationship with God. So here on Breadbox Media, we've been setting the record straight in a way that we hope offends no one. We're just judging some things as better than other things, and some cultures is perhaps more favorable to saving one's soul than other cultures. And that's no small thing. This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm setting the record straight again. See you later. This is Chuck Coughlin.